Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Spotlight on Youth. My name is Lauren Litton. I'm the host of the show. Spotlight on Youth is dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. It is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. And then you will press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question. You'll be placed in a queue to be on air. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. Today, we are extremely fortunate to have James Bell, the founder and executive director of the W. Haywood Burns Institute, and Clarence Williams, Jr., the director of the Louisville, Kentucky Metro Youth Detention Services, joining us. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Before we discuss the critical problem of overrepresentation of youth of color in our juvenile justice system, I want to introduce both of you to our audience. The W. Haywood Burns Institute is a national nonprofit organization whose mission is to protect and improve the lives of youth of color, poor youth, and the well-being of their communities by reducing the adverse impacts of public and private youth serving systems and to ensure fairness and equity throughout the juvenile justice system. The Burns Institute, which is named after civil rights pioneer W. Haywood Burns, was awarded the prestigious MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. The award is presented to select organizations worldwide that have had a remarkable impact in their fields. Since 2001, James Bell has been spearheading a national movement to address racial and ethnic disparities in the juvenile justice system. James and his colleagues work with juvenile justice systems across the country to reduce the disproportionality of youth of color. He guides the Community Justice Network for Youth, the national network of programs working successfully with young people of color. He also works closely with the KC Foundation's JDAI organization, jurisdictions and the MacArthur Foundation Models for Change Initiative. He has been recognized for his work by numerous organizations, including being awarded the Ella Baker Septima Clark Human Rights Award, the Livingston Hall Award from the American Bar Association, and the Advocate of the Year from the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. He was also named 2011 as a change maker by the San Francisco Chronicle. Mr. Bell holds a Juris Doctor from the Hastings College of Law. Okay. Since 2001, Clarence Williams, Jr. has been the director of the Youth Detention Services for the Louisville Metro Government, the largest juvenile detention center in Kentucky. He has also been responsible for community-based services, which includes a 12-bed emergency shelter and detention alternatives programming for up to 130 youth. I lost the connection there. So he serves on the Louisville Disproportionate Minority Confinement Advisory Board, studying and addressing overrepresentation of minority youth in the local detention center. This is the risk of technology today. He is a member of the Louisville Criminal Justice Commission Board and serves as chair of the Louisville Alliance for Youth, providing funding to community and faith-based organizations working with at-risk youth. Clarence received his Bachelor's of Science in Psychology from the St. Cloud University in Minnesota. In the description of our show, we cited a statistic that youth of color make up 38% of the entire youth population in the United States, yet comprise nearly 70% of those who are confined. Disproportionate minority contact, or what we call DMC, unfortunately is not a new problem, and is rooted in the historical context of how our country and the institutions develop. Today, James and Clarence are here to provide an overview of the issue and to talk about how to redress DMC in the juvenile justice system at both policy and programmatic levels. I thought perhaps we could start out by providing some of that historical framework for why there's disparate treatment of youth of color and then move into what we mean when we talk about DMC. James, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Few people know a lot of the history of how we've come to this kind of system that reflects the statistics that you've just talked about. So one of the things that it's important to know is that prior to the establishment of the juvenile court, that most young people, there were not separate laws, there weren't compulsory education laws, there weren't status offenses, and children and adults went to work together, they went to prison together, they went to bars together, and it wasn't until 1899, around 1900, that the states decided that they needed to engage in intervening in the lives of children whose parents were unable to care for them in the way that it was seen to be appropriate. Since that time, in the North, most of the facilities were segregated even then. So from the beginning of the juvenile court in 1900, most of the resources were spent on white youth. The facilities that were constructed for white youth. And in the South, where segregation was, in fact, legal and as a part of public policy, many of the young kids of color that were seen to be wayward or in trouble with the law actually went with adults into the convict leasing system and into work camps. And so the system that we have today is a significant change from what it was in its earliest iteration. And so for many people that join the juvenile justice or the youth justice system today, they are surprised to know that about 20 years ago or 15 years ago, it was a mostly white system. And that it wasn't until the 90s, essentially, that young people of color started coming into this system in large numbers, basically based on legislation that was around drugs and other forms of zero tolerance policies and things of that nature. So it's a recent phenomena to have this number of young people of color in the system. And with the demographics of our country changing, I'm living in the state California where 6 of 10 people are people of color already. With those demographics changing, it is going to be clearly an issue that all the states are going to have to deal with. And there are two things that I want to say as a predicate for the conversation for the listeners. And one is that when you look at the numbers that you've cited, beyond the historical perspective in terms of kids of color being put into this system because of legislative activity over the last 15 years or so, what we know is that the overrepresentation of young people of color in the justice system cannot be explained by crime alone. So the notion of they do more crime, therefore they should be involved in the system in the numbers that they are, just simply don't bear out in the data. And the second thing that we are talking about that it's important for the listeners to understand is those of us like Clarence and myself that do this work, we are not, and it's very important to say, we are not talking about a quota system. We are not involved in this work to say if you have 23% population of blacks and 15% population of, let's say, Latinos in a jurisdiction, that the youth justice system has to reflect those numbers equally. People think that it's like, oh, okay, well, if it's 18% and it's 18%, everything is fine. That actually is not the case. And so it is not a quota system. It is not about numerical parity with the population. What it is about is making sure that because of your race, ethnicity, gender, or preference, that justice is not administered and you are not treated differently than anyone else. And so what we know is that when there are policies that are ill thought, they fall hardest on communities of color. And so we examine, the work that we do is to examine what the policies and practices are. And Clarence wants to make sure that when he administers justice in Louisville, that in fact there isn't such a thing as justice by geography. So that you, if you're in the zip code of the rich folks and you steal a car as a 15-year-old, or you're in the zip code of the poor folks and you steal a car at 15, justice should be similar for both of those. It should not be that one gets wildly different results just because of one's circumstance and status.
And James, just as you said that, and I was thinking about how the entire Department of Juvenile Justice became to be here in Kentucky, you know, was simply because this state was housing juveniles with adult offenders, and we ended up with a consent decree that forced us to create a Department of Juvenile Justice just to specialize on the detention of juveniles. It's amazing to me that it always seems as if something has to occur negatively to prompt any kind of move forward in this industry.
So that's, you know, maybe we were going to talk about something else first, but that's a very interesting question. So there are still communities, you know, where litigation has not occurred and people know that issues exist. And James, you're talking about policies that are, you know, ill thought out. How does a community begin to examine what policies are there and address them without being under something like a consent decree?
Oh, very easily, because, in fact, there aren't enough lawyers to cover all the places where racial and ethnic disparities go. So I don't want to say it's easy, but
yeah,
certainly there have to be avenues for system accountability. Clarence is a public official, and he is working at the behest of the people of his jurisdiction, and they have to come forward for a budget every year. Any public system, whether it's schools, whether it's the public health system, the public mental health system, any of those public hospitals, any of those need to be accountable for what they do. And so any community should be able to query those that run their justice system about the kind of questions that we're here discussing today. Do you have racial and ethnic disparities and overrepresentation? Do you have a plan to do anything about that? What is your goal with regard to how you want to address it? And so communities can definitely get involved. Now, as with anything else, folk need to know some of the inside of how the sausage is made, where the important decisions and meetings are to deal with this thing, these things. But the Burns Institute has task forces around the country who are specifically in their communities making sure that folk know how the juvenile justice system is working and the kinds of questions that officials like Clarence and other officials need to be able to account for in the way that they go about their business.
So, Clarence, it sounds like your community really has been working to reduce DMC. Can you provide an overview of when that started, what the approach has been, and some of the challenges
Absolutely.
And successes to date? Great.
Back in early 2003, there's obviously a group of people here in Louisville, the Louisville Crime Commission, that works with the juvenile justice and adult justice stakeholders in this community. And there was an opportunity to get with the Department of Juvenile Justice in the state of Kentucky and go for a grant to do some work around disproportionate minority confinement or contact here in the state of Kentucky. And it was a competitive bid between Louisville and Fayette County and some other counties here in the state. We were fortunate enough to be awarded that grant, and that's when our relationship with the W. Hayward Burns Institute started. In doing that work, you know, I think the very first thing is you had to have a committed group of people here in this jurisdiction. And in finding those people, you got to make sure you have the right people at the table, meaning people who can help make decisions and people who are willing to work. fortunately for this jurisdiction, we had the Crime Commission here who had already begun working with the stakeholders in this community around different issues and injustice. So it was just natural that the Disproportionate Minority Confinement or Contact Committee would end up being a subset of the Louisville Crime Commission. And ever since then, that group has been meeting monthly, working on different strategies, obviously with the help of the Barnes Institute, and trying to really execute a plan that would affect how juveniles are treated in the justice system here in Louisville.
So the first thing that I think has to happen that Clarence is reflecting is we bring together, to do this work, I believe, to really impact racial and ethnic disparities, the key point is we bring together people that normally would not organically come together just as a matter of course. And that is folk in the community, maybe some parents, maybe some youth, but at least community providers, community natural leaders, which could be seen to be religious leaders or other people in the community that just have a family that's known and well-respected. And so we want to bring them, along with Clarence and his colleagues, the judge, the prosecutor, the indigent defender, the probation department, law enforcement, we want to bring them to a table and to say, let's identify the problem with regard to race and ethnicity. And we do that with data collection. But what we want to do is sit around the table and, as a team of people, try to figure this out. And so the first thing we do is bring together those community people who are often see the system as their enemy or not helpful to them, and bring together the systems people who have the power to make decisions about the lives of the young people in their community, to sit down and look at a set of data, which is the way we quantify the problem, and then begin to solve it. Because Clarence and his colleagues make decisions all the time, and they have that power and authority, but oftentimes they don't have the same kind of relationships with the young people that they're dealing with that somebody in the community does. And somebody in the community, even though they have those relationships, they don't have the power and authority and the access to funds that the court and the other system could bring. And so our point is to bring these folks together as a team to begin to answer this question. Because our belief is that if you leave the community out, your solutions will ultimately will come up short. They may be okay, but they won't be as effective as they could be.
And I have to chime in on that and say that the community aspect is so important to making sure that these initiatives that the group comes up with can be continued. You know, everything can't be fixed by the system. The people have to take ownership of their community, of their youth, and buy into helping that move forward. The other thing I thought was interesting is when you talk about not having the resources, I mean, there's some things that the community brings to the table that a system stakeholders never even think about. They just have a completely different perspective on what it is that you do. And so a big portion of this group getting together is an education for the stakeholders from the community's aspect, and an education of the community members from the stakeholders' aspect.
So I think, I want to talk more about that, about also involving and educating the community, but first want to get back to concretely describing the issues. And, James, you said people need to be using a set of data. And the Burns Institute published this report called The Nonjudicial Drivers into the Juvenile Justice System for Youth of Color. And it is posted along with this radio show's website, so people who are interested should go there. But in that report, you indicated that while no two youth justice systems are exactly the same, there are several common decision points within the process at which overrepresentation can be measured, which
right.
seems to link to the data. So can you describe
right.
what are these decision points for us?
Well, the first thing, and as a contextual piece in terms of this, often people hear about data and their eyes just, you know, roll over and they're just like, oh, my God. What we're talking about doing is really not scientific, double-blind, control studies, but participatory research and analyzing data. And so if you were to go to a system and see and try to deconstruct it to see where it is that let's assume that there are five white kids being assigned to that system for various types of misbehavior, and let's say there are eight black kids being assigned to that system. Eventually, what we know from the data is those five white kids are going to end up being one, and those eight black kids are going to end up being five. And so what we want to know is, where is it? Where are the decision points where essentially white kids get Teflon'd out and kids of color get Velcroed in? And so one of the things that we want to look at is, how did the kid get sent to the juvenile justice system in the first place? Did their parent bring them in and leave them at Clarence's door and say, I can't handle them, you take them? Did a school teacher call the school resource officer and say, this child just kicked the garbage can, we can't have that in this class, you know, you do what you need to do with him? Did law enforcement pick him up, hanging out on the corner, doing something that they thought was a violation of the law? So we want to know what is the stream that the kids come from. And so that's why we try to measure the decision points. One is referral, who refers them. Two, once they are referred, and law enforcement brings, does law enforcement arrest? Once they're referred, is law enforcement in, do they arrest or not? Once law enforcement arrests, they're supposed to take the young person to some professional that is in Clarence's orbit, whether it's intake and, you know, however this is organizationally structured. These are the basic things. Somebody in the profession has to make the decision that this child is too dangerous to let go, or and therefore they need to be detained, or they should be let go. And so what we find is it is those initial decisions that we focus on heavily, because once you're in the system and it has its hands on you, it's very hard to get out of that system. I liken it to cleaning a house. This morning when I left, I said, am I going to do the dishes in the sink from last night? Now, if I had somebody looking over my shoulder, I'm liable to say no. I'm liable to get in trouble. But since I'm not in the system, I can walk out the house, not do my dishes, and no one's going to care. But if I had a social worker coming by every day, they're going to say you have dirty dishes. And so once you're in the system, it's very hard to extricate yourself, because you have scrutiny by people of normal behavior. And so what we want to do is focus on those decisions before you actually are brought deeper into the system. So those are some of the decision points we look at. And I think your audience can figure out, as you go deeper into the system, we look at, you know, how many kids pled out, how many kids went to trial, and we look at all of those by race, ethnicity, gender, and geography.
Okay, just a reminder to our listeners that they can call in at 347-994-1147 and push number 1 on their telephone keypad to ask a question or post a question in our chat room. Clarence, those decision-making, points of decision-making, did your community look at them, and what did you find as far as trends there?
Absolutely. here in Louisville, one of the most difficult things was when we were sitting around the table discussing our particular decision-making points was, you know, a lot of times people in a group setting like that have a difficult time accepting their responsibility around a particular thing, whether it's the police or here in the state of Kentucky, we have the court-designated workers office. Who is that person, that professional who is allowed to make a decision about whether or not a kid stays in detention or is released from detention? You have some judges, maybe they feel as if, because those CDWs or court-designated workers have to call the judge. The judge is a little defensive, but it's critically important because that all the stakeholders are at the table so that the little intricacies of each decision point can be vetted out. You have to, because if you miss something, it could be that one thing that throws off your data collection.
Right.
And we were very fortunate to have all those people around the table here in Louisville, and we took a look at those particular decision points, and it was very interesting. Here in Louisville, we had, the largest group of people where we got referrals to the detention center here in Louisville was from the actual decision made at arrest by the court-designated worker. And then also there was the kids that came from actual court. So the kid would have been arrested. They would have been either cited at that point and given a court date to go later, or come to the back door and then been released and went back to court. And then the judge, when they went back to court, decided they needed to come to detention. So those were some areas that we had to look at very closely when we began looking at the issue here in Louisville.
And one of the things that I think is very important to highlight, that the reason you need to go through the process that Clarence just talked about, is because one of the things that very few people in the public know, I'm going to go back to my initial statement, that few kids of color, the overrepresentation can be justified by crime alone. One of the things that we've seen, and this is why the process that Clarence talked about that they're participating in is so important, and as Clarence also mentioned, that it's important to keep it sustained, that this isn't just a project and then after 6 months you go, okay, well, we're on to something else. You have to build it into how your system works. Is a lot of kids from poor neighborhoods, or what we call neighborhoods of concentrated poverty, are sent to the juvenile justice system because other systems can't serve them. And so they are a low risk for public safety, but they have high service needs. So a kid whose parent may be incarcerated and their other parent is driving a bus and therefore not there to supervise them at the level that the court thinks, oftentimes will be detained because the parent can't be contacted. A young person that is acting up in school may not be diagnosed that they may have just a reaction to frustration of no real outlets in their neighborhood. And so they act out. And so if you're in a school that has a zero tolerance policy, your acting out will much more likely land you in the criminal justice system than a child with means and resources. And so one of the things that the justice system conflates is high risk for future criminality and public safety versus high need for services. And our position is, and one of the things that we have the people around the table work on, is the juvenile justice system and being in a cage, a cell, whatever you want, you can pretty up the word, but it's 9x6, and it's basically a place for you to just sit. It is, one, not, as we know now, it's really not appropriate in terms of adolescent development, in terms of what the impact is of sitting a kid in a room for that amount of time and what adolescents normally need. We know that. And so we know that detention is not a benign experience, so it should be used very carefully, and it definitely should not be used for kids that have service needs, but, people in the system will say, well, there's no funding for that. And who's always open is the justice system. And that's why we need people around the table, so that people like Clarence can say, really? I'm not appropriate for these young people are not appropriate from my jail. It's not appropriate to put a kid that isn't going to school in my jail. Now, we need to do something with them, but that is not what we should do with them. We need to figure out something else. We can put them in those jails, but actually we shouldn't. And so that is really why it's important to have the other people around the table, because in so many places, juvenile detention is acting like a hospital. It's acting like a mental health institution. It's acting like a school. And at its worst, it's acting like a nanny.
So you said that very well. And I want you to say more about the why we shouldn't. What is the impact on the youth and on their families and the communities of putting youth in detention and into actually secured confinement as we're going in deeper into the system for kids who are low risk yet have high service needs? And Clarence, you probably have some examples, too, of how the system has actually harmed youth more than helped. So if you can share some of that to really illuminate what we're talking about.
Well, I know that, that studies have shown, when a child is in secure detention and they're not supposed to be, their outcomes are worse. Their outcomes are worse for school. Their psychosocial development is hurt. There's also the issue of, this my particular institution here holds kids who have murder charges and, are extremely likely to be in the deep end of the system, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And to have a kid who's simply truant from school in a facility with somebody who is much more sophisticated criminally is not a good thing, because some of that behavior can be passed along, whether it's how to rob somebody, there's just all kinds of problems with less sophisticated offenders being introduced to people with much more sophisticated minds, criminal minds. We have, one of the issues that we struggle with here in the state of Kentucky is the detention of status offenders. And that obviously a status offense is anything that you can be detained for or arrested for that you wouldn't be arrested for if you were an adult. So you have truants who get arrested. You have people for underage drinking who get arrested. You have shoplifting. So you have a lot of status offenses where people who, if they were 18 or older, wouldn't be incarcerated, but in this state, they have to come to the detention centers. And so that is just, it's not a really good place for a child who may need simply some supervision.
Yeah, and Clarence has really hit it on the head, and I want to make sure that I won't speak for Clarence, but I will certainly speak for those of us at the Burns Institute. We are not saying that no child should not be removed from their community ever. That is not our position. There are some young people that unfortunately have been so damaged that they just can't matriculate amongst the rest of us, and in order to protect us, we use this tool, which is detention. However, what we're trying to do is to try to use that tool as rarely and as intelligently as possible. And unfortunately, we're in a society that uses detention as this is the way it shakes down in the U.S. in most counties. And places like Louisville, where Clarence is working, is thinking about how to do it differently. Currently, the way we do it now is anything happens, lock them up first, and then we'll figure out the stuff while, we'll figure it out while you're locked up. And what we're trying to say is, first of all, as a society, we can't afford those inefficiencies anymore. It's very expensive to have that approach. Lock them up, and then we'll figure it out. My sister's a social worker in Los Angeles, and she said that they were told, in terms of child welfare cases and child endangerment cases, she was like, the message was, get those kids out of the house and put them someplace, because you don't want to be in the paper the next day that one of those children died. So we're going to err on the side of getting them out and putting them in foster care. And it's the same thing. People in the juvenile justice system is, we're going to err on the side of locking them up and figure out later. And I'm saying, you know, there are a few of us out here and places that we're working with, like Louisville, are saying, wait a minute, why don't we think about putting them someplace else first and not have lockup as the first response? Because the truth is, Clarence can tell you, the overwhelming majority of kids that are referred to the court are not staying in the court. They're going to be moved on. And so why use that really expensive? And as Clarence mentioned, it's really not, you know, a good psychosocial thing to do for most of these kids. And actually use the resource for those kids that scare us all and really need the kind of security that detention provides.
Just to speak to the expense, since you mentioned that, I mean, it here in Louisville, it costs roughly $250 a night to house a juvenile in this building. And so I don't know about, I mean, I know you live in San Francisco, James, and that's probably the standard hotel room out there. But here,
yeah, our
in
detention
Louisville,
is $350, $370 a night.
Yeah. So, but here, that's a pretty expensive night, and I believe that the taxpayers would probably prefer that a kid who had possession of cigarettes or was a runaway used it a more appropriate alternative than detention.
Exactly.
So let's get concrete. Clarence, maybe you can, why don't you tell us what is being done in Louisville? So what are the things that you're looking at trying? What have you tried to implement already? We've had a question, if you can give some examples.
Okay. Well, I'll give you, for instance, when we took a look at the kind of kids who were basically low risk but still in the detention center, we found that we had kids who were dropped off at the detention center whose parents couldn't be found, and we became the place where they sat until the parent could be found.
Exactly.
Or they'd end up spending the night waiting until the court ended up having to issue a subpoena or something for the parent. So that was one group of kids. We also found that we had a large group of kids detained for warrant, whether that was just a warrant for not failing to appear in court or some kind of violation of a program, whether it was home incarceration, home supervision, and they were being placed back into the detention center. So right off the bat, we knew right away that those were some populations that we could work with as to making sure that they didn't have to be here. So we created a field release program, which allows for kids who the police cannot find their parent to go to, we have here, the YMC Safe Place. I contracted with YMC Safe Place to take those kids in, spend the time with those particular kids, do an assessment, try to get an understanding of their needs, and then reunite them with their parents. Youth detention pays for that. It's about $94 per child, but that's better than paying $250 if they have to stay the evening. As far as the bench warrants and kids on violations, we began a bench warrant review. We also had, you know, in previous years prior to this initiative, any kid who came to youth center on a bench warrant got locked right up. There was no reviewing of the case, trying to understand whether or not they were, it was just a failure to show if they didn't have the right address or whatever. So we got with our group of people, we worked with the chief judge, we worked with the prosecutor, public defender, said, why don't we, you know, most kids seem to come to court the next day right at 9 o'clock. So if we allow, if it's a low-risk offender, you know, who's in on a bench warrant, say he's got a misdemeanor charge, but he didn't fail to show, we're going to go ahead and release that kid to his parent, but they have to show up the next day at 9 o'clock for court. We implemented that review process. Immediately we had about a 96% return rate for every kid that we let out on a bench warrant for them to come back and show up in court. So that's worked really well for us.
One of the things that I wanted to say as Clarence was going through these responses that they've done is, you know, we don't have a lot of time on this radio show, and people just think that it just falls into place. For every one of those things that Clarence mentioned was a tremendous amount. You know, it's like going to a great dinner that just comes out of the kitchen. You know, there's a lot of work going on back there in order to make this stuff look good. And for the stuff that Clarence and them have put in place in Louisville, it's a tremendous amount of work. One is the collaboration, had to cooperate, as he said, the DA, the public defender, the judge. They all have to sit there and say, okay, we want to figure this out. Then you have to have the data to be able to find out the issue that Clarence identified. Then once you have that data, you have to, you know, engage community folks to say, okay, why aren't people coming to court? What does this mean? What does that mean? Then you put in that change that he says you've put in. But before that change goes in, there's a lot of background work that has to happen. And it's rare, I think as people should know for the show, it's rare for a system to self-examine itself, do the things that Clarence has just suggested on their own. Usually they need some kind of help or assistance from the outside because they just don't have the ability to do that, to do all of those steps by themselves, because usually people, you know, somebody thinks that their ox is going to get gored or they're going to have to share money that they don't want to have to share. So they're, you know, these things, although Clarence gave a great resuscitation of what, how you make change, it ain't that easy.
Right.
Yeah. I agree wholeheartedly that the ability to compromise between stakeholders is crucial, and you have to have the wherewithal to have some arguments with your counterparts. I mean, you know, for the police to not to be able just to drop kids off at the detention center because they can't find the parent, have to drive to a runaway shelter.
Right.
I mean, that took me, myself, and some other stakeholders, the judge and CDW's office, going to roll call for every single shift.
Right.
And all 10 police districts in our area. So that's 7-3, 3-11, 11-7 roll call at every precinct to get that message disseminated out to the officers. And then having to field their questions and their concerns, let them understand that the kid will be there, you won't be liable for dropping them off, and all of these kind of things.
Exactly.
So those initiatives take – that initiative in itself took almost 2 years before it was up and running community-wide.
James, we have a question for you because you've been working with so many different communities across the country. What are some other commonalities on both the challenge and success side that communities should be thinking about, you know, if they want to engage in reducing DMC?
Right. So I think by now the listeners, the people that are streaming, should get the sense that my point of view is always that that there's context and a concept that you have to come from. You can't just start in the middle. You have to actually understand in the beginning. So the first place to understand is justice systems in this country are not used to being accountable to the citizenry. If I'm running a jail, if I'm the sheriff of whatever county in the 3,100 counties that make up the United States of America, the number one thing that I don't want to have happen in my jail is a death. A suicide or a death, or you know, some kind of serious rape that comes into injury, because then we're going to get scrutiny. But barring a rape or a murder in most jails, the public has no idea what happens there. They don't think it's great stuff, but they don't think it's horrible stuff, and they kind of think that the person that's in there is in there for a good reason, that really good people don't go to jail. So essentially, the justice system has had a total pass on how it does business because of that bargain I've just articulated. Most people believe that in order to be in jail, you did something bad, and most people believe that they're good. And so even though the place ain't great, that you probably deserve what you're getting. And as a result of that attitude, justice people never or rarely have to explain how they do business. So the common challenge is for us to do what Clarence and I have been talking about. The first major threshold is getting a justice system to actually think that they don't just, you know, crawl into a ball like a bug or something when you ask why. Why do you do this? Why do you do that? So the first hurdle everywhere that you have to overcome is the notion that the justice system should be accountable to the community. And that is a challenge everywhere we go. And the success, the thing that's one, and so once they say we're going to look at ourselves to be accountable, the way that they usually come to that is either by heat, meaning that a community is up in arms about what the justice system is doing and demands some answers, or light, and that is someone like Clarence gets in a position of power and has the authority and the ability to, with his peers, he's not a dictator, with peers and everybody else, ask some questions to say, well, why do we do this? Or why is it that the girls stay twice as long as the boys? I mean, that he's in a position of power, so he can ask that. So once you have the heat or the light to get the justice system to actually scrutinize how it does business, then, so those are the challenges everywhere. Then the successes are incredible because these are talented people. Many of them got into the work because they like children and they like young people, and then they wanted to help lives, but they just were stuck in a system that didn't quite know how to get its footing. And so the successes can be is once the justice system has, you know, for lack of a better term, an aha moment that they can do things differently, it's amazing how significantly quickly you know, once the system has bought in, once the adults, as Clarence hinted to, start deciding they want to play well together, things can move really well for children that are in trouble with the law.
Just to piggyback on what you said, James, I mean, just one of the particular issues here in Jefferson County in Kentucky, when we first started this initiative, our prosecutor said that every kid who was arrested at school had to go before the judge, even if it was a misdemeanor.
Right.
Okay? Now, if usually first-time misdemeanor charges, for instance, if you're a shoplifter out in the community, will get diverted to a not, you know, to the CDW's office, but in a non-formal manner. It can be handled in a non-formal manner. But for some reason, even if you had a misdemeanor in school, which a lot of people had because they were stealing people's, you know, cell phones or or just an assault for, kind of got into an argument or a fight with another kid, those kind of things. But the prosecutor said, I'm sorry, we're drawing a line of stand. All kids who have school offenses go before the judge. I don't care how, you know, minor the charge is. And for, I would say, almost 2.5 years, until we, you know, just kept working on them and working on them and working on them, did they begin to change how he thought about that?
Right.
And those are the kind of things where you say, you know, they ball up into a little ball like a bug and don't take their toys and go home, don't want to play. Sometimes that happens.
Right.
With particular parts of the system.
And see, the thing that I go back to, and that, because when I listen to that example, it just rings so true in terms of what we experience and around the country. Now, if that person, I'm not going to even talk about the prosecutor of Louisville because I don't know, but I can talk about people that we've worked in places that are people that are professionals, people of means, people that can access resources. Clarence said something very important. When I was coming up, what was considered normal teenage behavior, he just rattled off three crimes for, is an assault for. I mean, what kid, when we were growing up, did not get their bicycle stolen when they went to the store to get Red Hots? I mean, it's just like that is a part of life. And we just never thought, oh, somebody stole my bike, I'll be a witness in court, in juvenile court. You know, it was like the community figured this out. So your parents would say, I told you to lock it. Or you'd see the kid with the bike, and then you'd get in a fight about it and try to take it. I mean, but we work these things out extrajudicially. And it was considered this is what you do as a part of development as a teenager. Now, all of that behavior is about four felonies, which me and that is a problem. But if you have resources, if you have means, if you have access to resources and means, I guarantee you that those people aren't saying that any kid in school should go before a judge, because I know in Louisville, in St. Louis, Missouri, in San Francisco, California, everywhere you go in this country, there are a set of people that have their kids in private schools doing the exact same behaviors, and the thinking is, they will not go before a judge. Not at all.
Yeah, that,
the response
at
those schools is not police, not metal detectors. The response at those schools are what should be the response in the schools that are poor schools as well. And
absolutely.
I've said this often. People with money, when they send their kids to school, to private schools, they're paying for tolerance. Mm-hmm. Poor people get zero tolerance.
Clarence, you sound like you wanted to add something to that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Clarence.
No, I actually was going to make the same point. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. I mean, at least in our jurisdiction, most of all of the public schools, middle schools, and most of the public high schools have the school resource officer. The private schools, they have a person who is in charge of discipline, but they don't have a police officer sitting in the hallway.
Right. And my dad was the vice principal.
Yeah, I mean, the police have an obligation, if something is reported to them and or witnessed, to do their job.
Right.
They're sworn to do that.
Absolutely.
If they're not on the premises to be told or to be seen, if the disciplinarian decides not to call them, it didn't happen.
Right. And so, right. And that's a very good point that Clarence is making. That's not a knock on police.
No.
That's the position they've been put in and told to do that job. That's a knock on those that think that that's the way that we should discipline children. This is not a knock on the cops. That's the job they were told to do.
So we have about 8 minutes left. And, I think both of you are talking really about envisioning where we really need to go and how a community we should be addressing this. But, Clarence, maybe first I'd like to hear from you what our next steps for Louisville, you know, what you'd like to see happen. And then, James, maybe you can give sort of a big picture of, where we would be at the forefront of DMC, what are some things in the next year or two that you would like to see both at the different levels, maybe federal government, states, and communities doing?
Sure.
Okay. Well, at least on the local level here in Louisville, I mean, what we're looking to be doing here in the future is really to begin to develop more of our community relationships. There is a disconnect between when, in a lot of cases, when a child goes through the system, and for instance, my services, whether it's a community-based service or detention, that when that child gets finished and he is done with their case and they get sent home, what are they being sent home to, and are we able to provide them some sort of help outside of these walls or the constraints of my organization?
Right.
So we need to build a relationship with the communities that our children are coming from, so that we can help that child while he's back at home and to stay out of trouble and not reoffend and not get back in the system. So that's one of the things that we're really focusing on here in Louisville. We're also focusing on a restorative justice initiative here. The Louisville Bar Association and the Louisville Crime Commission are working to really deal with some of the low-level offenders in a family group conferencing setting, trying to come up with some alternatives to the juvenile justice system as a whole. And hopefully the more success that that program would have, they'll begin to take a look at some more serious offenses that could possibly go through those that program as well. And so really, and then lastly, we have to monitor everything that we've done in the past, you know, 8 years, and follow the trends and respond accordingly to any, you know, unusual blips on the radar screen around DMC. So that's pretty much the plan here in Louisville, and that's what we'll be doing moving forward.
And I would say that those things that Clarence mentioned are wonderful for any community to do. And it's great for communities like Louisville, with Clarence there working, are trying to get ahead of this curve. So for me, what it looks like are what Clarence talked about on the ground is what I think we are trying to push. And that is a notion that we've been in meetings about, and I've been in discussions with Clarence and a set of academics and people who work in the system like Clarence and advocates and other people that we are bringing together. And the notion is where we would like to go is that the frame start with child well-being. That when we look at a child at age 5, age 9, age 13, what is it that that young person should be afforded in order to be a productive citizen in the beginning of the second decade of the 21st century? What are the skills that that young person is going to need to have to contribute in a global multinational world? And so if they're poor or if they're from a place with means, the question is, what should they be given? And which system, if their parents can't give it to them, should we use to give it to them? And detention and justice is just a small part of child – it should only be a small part of child-serving systems that has a very specific task, to separate those that are too dangerous to be among us. And, you know, Clarence can't give you the actual – may be able to give you the actual number, but in percentages, if we were to take every detention center in this country and say that the only people who will be in there are the ones that are so dangerous that they can't be in society and walk out that door, I could tell you we'd probably release about 70% of the kids that we have there now. And so the point is, how do we use the justice system and it's what it offers to promote child well-being and the other child-serving systems, as Clarence intimated, to make sure that if I'm a 5-year-old in the poorest of poor neighborhoods, and I'm a 5-year-old in a neighborhood with resources and means, that our society says you should be getting those things. If you're squinting to see the board, you need to get glasses. We shouldn't have to wait for you to get frustrated, throw an eraser at the teacher, and now you're in the justice system because you can't see the board. Mm-hmm. So that's where we're going in terms of laying out a new positive future for young people.
Well, I wish we had another hour. Maybe the two of you will join us again, and I hope that there would be no technology issues. I apologize again for that. I want to let the listeners know that they should visit the Burns Institute's website, which is burnsinstitute.org, and also a copy of the report that we mentioned is on the Children's Law Center's website, which is childrenslawky.org. Thank you both so much for being here today. Really appreciate it. It was wonderful information.
Thank you.
Our next episode will feature Judge Linda Teodosio and Steve Stahl from Summit County Juvenile Court. They are one of 5 counties in Ohio implementing the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative, so really we'll be building off some of what we talked about today, and they'll be joining us to discuss their experiences to date. So to stay informed about this and other upcoming shows, you can follow us here on Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on You. Thank you.